Good afternoon and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio. My name is Paul Bass and I invite you to join us to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community and our state tick. We have in the studio today the pleasure of meeting someone who's looking to make Connecticut tick as our next Secretary of the State.
Correct.
I had to learn early on to say the.
Yes.
Otherwise, I went through talking about Henry Kissinger back then.
Exactly.
And our guest today is Stephanie Thomas. She's a state representative from Norwalk, and she is one of a group of Democrats who are seeking the nod to become the next Secretary of the State. That's our top elections official. That's the person who oversees elections, works with town clerks, and registrars of voters, deals with absentee ballots, certifies elections, and also runs the state's commercial business registry. The job is open. Denise Merrill, who's had it, I think, for three, four-year terms, is retiring, so that's why we're seeing the stampede. Stephanie Thomas, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's very nice to see you.
And I just want to give a nod. I represent Norwalk, Wilton, and Westport.
That must be it. You drive a lot, I take it.
I do.
New Haven, we can walk certain places.
Yes.
Or bike, but not out in Wilton and Westport.
A lot of miles.
So, Stephanie Thomas, why are you running for Secretary of State?
I'm running for many reasons, but I think the one reason that rises to the top is there's something that's been left out of the conversation that I haven't heard anyone speaking about, and not just here in Connecticut, but nationally as well. We spend a lot of time talking about voter registration, expanding voting rights, and those things are very important, but the other leg of the stool, so to speak, is civic education and civic engagement. And you can have as many people registered, as many people with rights, but if they are not exercising that right, our representative form of democracy is lost. And I feel like apathy has been winning more elections than many of our political parties. And when you couple that with this general feeling of distrust of government, distrust of elections, it just feels like we are skating on thin ice right now. So I'd like to insert that into the conversation and into the role of the secretary.
That is so interesting because, as you know, this is a job that people did not used to spend a lot of attention to, pay a lot of attention to. Now this job gets tons of attention all over the country because of the 2020 election and efforts on both sides to change how we vote, what rules are. And as you just pointed out, on both sides of our political divide, there's a deep distrust of government, there's a distrust of elections. So you want to tackle that as Secretary of the State?
I do. You know, I think no one talks about this at all, but in this country, it's considered a good turnout when 60% vote in federal elections and 40% vote in midterm elections, and I won't even talk about local. I mean, I think here in New Haven and many places around the state, the municipal elections often have less than 25%.
Well, that depends if there's a competitive race. So we will get up to, I think, 30 or 40, which is still not high,
but that's,
or close to 50 if there's a real race going on.
And most people focus on K through 12 civic education, which is important. But, you know, we have about 50 years before those people form the upper edge of our voting population, and I don't think we can afford to wait.
It's interesting. I feel like you were eavesdropping on conversations I had with Denise Merrill. She and I have talked on and on about civic education and having people become participants in our democracy more than just voting. And she had some ideas. I don't know if it went far because we were looking at it at the Independent about how do you do like courses for people on how to navigate the internet and find out, go to senior centers, go to colleges, go to teachers who teach other people how to use to find good information on the internet and use it as a way to link up with other people to then participate in your community.
Yeah.
But we also have this problem with fake news. So I don't mean like what politicians call fake news, but like what's real information, what's not. So I guess I'm interested in how you would address that. But before we get there, I want to ask you one central question. So for a lot of our lifetime, we've looked at that number, how many people vote in elections.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so in Russia, it's 95% because you get arrested if you don't, right? Or in Nicaragua,
but
then you have to vote a certain way. My personal thinking has evolved on this.
Okay.
For most of my life, I thought the important number was how many people voted. And it is an important number. Mm-hmm. It reflects how many things important. But now I've come to think that what's important is access, not just access to the ballot, but access to good information so that people can know what they're voting for.
Yeah.
So if last time we had a record turnout in the presidential election, I would argue that on both sides, it wasn't necessarily a very informed turnout. People were motivated by fears, genuine concerns. Doesn't mean they were voting based on good information. Yep. And I wonder if it would have been a better functioning democracy if rather than 150 million people voting, 110 million people had voted, but sort of the noisy news media hadn't had them confused about what they're really voting for. And if those 110 people were motivated and were casting informed ballots, is that anti-democratic to you?
I don't know if it's anti-democratic.
It's not rude to disagree, by the way.
I think it's not realistic. What I have learned from door knocking many, 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 many doors is that people vote for all different types of reasons. There are some people who are one-issue voters, as long as the one thing they care about, so they may be well-versed in that one area, and they don't care about everything else. There are people who vote in accordance with what their parents or their spouse or, you know, whatever thinks. So for me, I think it does matter the number because it speaks to civic engagement.
It is a measure of how much people care to come out.
It's understanding that, I mean, there is hardly anything we do that does not run through some elected official's hands, whether it's the quality of the air we breathe or trying to build a second bathroom in our house. I mean, literally, everything touches some elected official. But people don't understand that. Again, from door knocking, I know most people don't know their state rep from their congressional rep from what their town council does. So I think if people understood more, they would engage more and they would be more educated. Both have what we want.
And by the way, I do want what you want.
Yeah,
I think it's great that more people voting. Yeah. It's important. It's the fundamentals of our democracy.
Yes.
I guess what I'm a little more concerned about is the number of people who know what they're voting about. I don't know. It's just, and anyway, it gets back to your point about civic education. So how, as Secretary of the State, would you address this issue for people who aren't just K-12?
You know, it's a good question. I've been doing research over the last several months on this issue because I was thinking about if there was a bill I could introduce this session. And the good news, bad news is that no one has really figured this out. There are some think tanks, foundations, etc., working on this. And there are.
Can you say what this is? How to get people more involved
in
democracy.
How to get adults more involved.
Just voting, but like in their zoning boards and their running for office.
Engagement, both the understanding side, but also the engagement side. And there are a couple of programs, and there are some programs here for like college age. But I think we have a lot of networks that we had to set up for the census count, also for vaccine deployment.
Right, we've had some great grassroots networks for that in New Haven.
In New Haven, I think, is so civically engaged. So there are all these systems that maybe we can employ for voting education as well and civic education. I think sometimes, especially in the legislature, we look at a big solution, and sometimes it can be incremental. And I think that's more of my business background. You can't always solve for everything at once. And, you know, when I hear calls about voter fraud, sometimes I think it's just voter mistakes.
Well, there's no big numbers of voter.
Exactly. And it's usually mistakes. And if anyone has tried to understand absentee ballot envelope instructions or, you know, all of these things.
I did have trouble. I actually looked at that when I was
doing
a story
about it. You
have to
read it three times. You do.
I didn't really trust my understanding.
Yeah, you double check yourself. Everything is very complicated. Election law is complicated. I think if we had a website, the secretary does have a great website, but maybe we can do more to make even that more understandable for the layperson.
I don't think it's so understandable for layperson.
I agree.
I have to work at it as a reporter when I'm looking up stuff. Yeah. And plus, the fact that there's a separate state elections enforcement commission that, in fact, has the information you want on candidates is also very confusing
to
me.
It's tricky.
But, you know, I've talked to Dees Merrill about this. I want to update it. It's been a year or two since I talked about this. You know, about how you, as Secretary of State, you don't necessarily always need a bill. So if you, like, she was looking, I think, to partner with foundations and other groups that wanted to do this kind of adult education on civic engagement. That's one thing you do. I think you probably also have a budget for voter education and outreach, and you also have the website.
Yes.
So have you thought in nuts and bolts? You're in the process of beginning to think how you would accomplish that.
Thinking a little bit. I do want to push back on the legislature for
I didn't say you can't do anything legislature.
I only say that because I think it's important for buy-in and eventually for budget. The secretary does, of course, have a budget, but I'm sure Denise would tell you that she would love more dollars. And sometimes the best way to affect that is through the legislature. But in terms of nuts and bolts, there are a few things I would love to see on the website. I don't know what you would call it, a pathway document where, you know, a big issue, people are trying to figure out if they're eligible to vote. I'll leave it at eligibility for purpose of today and brevity. So if you had a pathway document with questions that you answer that lead you to a yes or no, that would actually clear up a lot of instances that some people have come before the legislature entitled fraud. But it's really honest mistakes because it's a very convoluted system. And I know there's been some high profile cases, not here, but in other states where, for example, I think it's Georgia. There's a woman who was formerly incarcerated, out on work release, thought she could vote, went and voted. No one told her she couldn't vote. And now she's being accused of fraud and is actually about to go back to jail. And
that was sick.
That could have just been easily.
And that was national politics make an example of somebody.
Exactly.
Pretty cruel.
Exactly.
But we're in Connecticut, which is not the land of milk and honey, but there's work to be done here as well.
Yes.
We're talking to Stephanie Thomas, state representative from Norwalk, one of the Democrats vying to become Secretary of State. In fact, you were the first out of the box.
I was
to
the
form
first
an official campaign committee. There were other people going around campaigning.
Yes.
But they called themselves exploratory candidates.
Correct.
Which meant that they didn't have to be all in yet. Why did you decide to go all in?
One,
so early.
Because it's who I am. I think it's difficult as a leader to do things halfway or to have your feet in two different sandboxes. I think you only achieve your goals when you're focused on them. And this job, to me, is a bit of a dream come true. I never expected Denise to retire. There were a lot of exploratory candidates, so I didn't necessarily think I would enter the race. But after exploring it, it really felt like I would regret it if I didn't, because it's a very natural fit for my background, my interests, and what I like to do. Mm-hmm. So background, interest, and passion, it's hard to pass that up in a job.
Okay, so that gets back to that first question. When I asked you why you're running, you answered first, I thought, very well about what you think needs to be done. You've just told me it fits with your background and interest. So specifically, why do you want to be the Secretary of State?
I've always run on a campaign of people over politics, and I think that is even more important in the Secretary's role. But in terms of my background, I think compared to anyone else, I'm a bit uniquely qualified. I have a long background in the nonprofit sector, but also as a business owner and also in the legislature. And to keep it brief, in nonprofit, you are accountable to your funders, and you don't get funding if you're not transparent, improve effectiveness. And I think
what kind of nonprofit did you run?
I did not run a nonprofit. So I've worked in nonprofits. I'm a fundraising consultant.
Oh, wow, you're currently valuable.
Yeah.
Like, who gets Stephanie this month? Because we got to pay our bills.
So I've worked for nonprofits and then as a consultant to nonprofits, which is what I still do currently.
So you're a fundraising consultant.
Correct.
It's a good thing for a politician running for office.
Yes, I raised $31,000 in 31 days, which was amazing.
They did put you in the first tier there.
Yeah, definitely. I think I outperformed everybody, certainly in 31 days.
I think Lesser, but in 31 days, yeah. I think Lesser had more, Matt Lesser from Middletown.
Well, most people have been in this race exploratory for months. Yeah. 30 days, I'll just underscore.
How'd you raise that money?
Grassroots support. You know, a few people have laughed because I've said I have not yet picked up the phone and made a call yet. But and they're like, how'd you raise that money without making calls? Luckily, I have always been consistent, I think, in how I approach people and the job I do. And people responded by thinking that I would be great in the role. And
so you're saying fun. So nonprofit experience gives you experience about being accountable and transparent and how you do things. So what, tell me about some of the nonprofits you've worked for.
For-profits or nonprofits? Nonprofits. So my business is in New York. So most of my nonprofits are there. So national organizations that people may know, something like National Urban League or A Better Chance.
Those are nice. So you have your own company in New York?
Correct.
Manhattan?
Yes.
You've been going in the office?
No.
You've been on remote.
The beauty is I'm the boss, so I get to decide. And once I entered this governmental space, I scaled down my business, so I work from home.
You say you also have a for-profit business experience background. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the first for-profit company I worked for, it was also a consulting company, and I rose from intern to president. Wow. So that tells you something about my work ethic. It was called Susan Ulin Associates. It has since closed. Mm-hmm. It was also a consulting company. And, you know, people don't think about consultants, what it means for a day-to-day managerial perspective. And, you know, we often would have 30 to 40 clients, which for me translated into about 700 emails a day, because in nonprofit consulting, you have many bosses.
So what time of night did you turn off your phone?
Oh my gosh. Well, this is why I care so much about voting and no excuse absentee ballots, because I would often be on the 4:53 train or the 5:23 and I would get home 9, 10 p.m.
That's a tough way to live.
It was.
And then you make the decision, if I turn off the phone now, I'll be able to sleep. But if I don't turn on the phone, then I'll have an extra 100 emails.
Exactly. And, you know, when you start your own business, you're basically, or at least I did, I signed up to work 80 to 100 hours a week, and I would often work 7 days. And
the for-profit consulting, what kind of consulting did they do? Were you also doing fundraising there?
So it's a for-profit company, but yes, working for nonprofits, which is what I still do,
okay.
Advising on fundraising strategy.
So Stephanie Thomas, you then went into politics. You've only been one term in the legislature, right?
Yep. This is my first
term. So what made you pivot to running for public office? How did that happen?
Like many people, so I just explained my work life, and I found after I moved to Connecticut, I was still too heavily invested in New York in terms of boards I sat on, where I gave my philanthropic dollars. And after the 2016 election, I thought, I'm going to scale down my work a little bit and get more involved locally, which first took the form of nonprofits, volunteerism. I volunteered for Chris Murphy's Fight Back. And in that process, and it's all very murky, that's when I learned about town committees and how they work and really how Connecticut politics worked. And I just got involved and I volunteered. I like to put my money where my mouth is, so to speak. And I signed up to be a delegate for the state rep run. And at the vote, there was no candidate. So I sort of raised my hand.
And so people know, even though conventions, we had this picture of like Kennedy picking Johnson in all those streamers or Daley sending the cops on the protesters.
Yeah, yeah.
A state rep convention means you got to round up a bunch of people who will fill the legal role of having the party nominate a candidate. And half the time you got to find someone who's willing to be a candidate,
exactly,
or people who are willing to show up at some school or some hall, you know, some crummy hors d'oeuvres for like an hour or something. Yeah.
So there was no candidate. And I started thinking about pipeline. And you may recall back in 2018, there was a very slim margin. The Senate was 50-50 and maybe a 6-seat differential in the House.
State.
State. Yeah. And I, you know, so I looked up my rep's record, and I didn't like, actually, how she had voted on early voting, which was against it, which is something that everybody I talked to in my district seemed to support. And so that day I decided, after about a week of saying, why isn't someone running? I hate to be a hypocrite. And I thought, hey, I own my own company, so I have some flexibility. I think I could do the job well. I called Hartford, found out what it would take, found out I had 4 days to petition my way onto the ballot. I reached out to two people who said, that's crazy. And I said, I'm going to attempt it anyway. And I got onto the ballot. I did lose, but only by 360 votes.
For the nomination or general campaign?
For the general campaign.
I lost to a Republican.
Yeah, yeah. A very popular incumbent who had
that?
Not, Gail LaViolle, who hadn't even been challenged since 2014. I actually was not going to run in 2020, but guess what happened? Early voting didn't pass again, and it's been a passion of mine. So I said, you know, I have to get to Hartford and see what's happening. and now, hey, it's
so
on the ballot.
So you became a state rep.
Yeah.
In a district that's not a full red or full blue district, right?
No, correct. I'm only the second Democrat ever, the first person from Norwalk, and it goes without saying, the first woman of color or person of color
to win that district.
Yeah.
And what did you find? How did you do it? Do you think that Wilden Westpark turned a little more liberal because of the Trump era? I mean, is there a realignment?
I definitely talk to a lot of Republicans. And when I go out campaigning, I talk to everybody. And I used to say, like, someone would say, oh, you know, I'm not of your party. And I'm like, well, if elected, I'd have to represent you as well. So isn't it better if I know what you're thinking about? And I just think that approach has always worked for me for everything. I'm a good listener. I like to listen to people. We may agree to disagree, and we may disagree, but it won't stop me from engaging in the conversation. And I think people have always just felt they had a fair dealing with me, and they've always been supportive. So I think that's why I won.
And then what did you find at the legislature? You joined the Government Administration Elections Committee, which is the committee that deals with
correct.
The kind of issues you deal with as Secretary of State. How did it work out? How's it been a state rep?
It was fantastic. I am vice chair of GAE. I also sit on the Commerce and Transportation Committees.
I mean, do you like being a state rep? You don't have to drive as much as before because a lot of stuff's online now, right?
I know. It's strange for me. It's always been virtual, so I don't know any different. It actually strikes me as being fairly efficient for, like, 10-minute committee meetings, for example.
But, you know, that I always find it kind of surreal walking in the Capitol.
Yeah.
I find it almost like political Disneyland. I mean, it's so grand and all those big columns and halls and ornate ceilings and marble, and I just kind of feel like there's an importance. Some people think that's great, the grandeur. Other people make you feel like it's a little artificial and disconnected.
I pay more attention to what's happening in the seats.
Mm-hmm. So have you felt you've been able to get stuff done? Like, what have you done in the legislature?
In the legislature, we've got a lot done. I'll focus on GAE because it's related to this topic. But obviously, I think most people know that we passed the ballot referendum, the constitutional amendment to allow for early voting. So that will appear on the ballot November 8th, 2022. Please
vote
yes.
Does that have to go twice or no?
No. So that went once already. We passed it again with a simple majority, but with bipartisan support, just not enough.
In the legislature?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to go twice before the voters?
No.
Okay, well, I don't know why I thought that. Maybe it's the two steps of the legislature. When you want to
it's
change
two steps of the legislature.
Legislature, if you could do a big enough majority, then it doesn't have to go to a referendum.
Correct.
But otherwise, you need a referendum. So early voting. And now, why are you passionate about early voting, Stephanie Thomas? What is it? Why is that a big issue to you?
There's so many reasons. You know, as a commuter, it just struck me as something that would have been very helpful. And from talking to hundreds, if not thousands of people, usually their barrier to voting, at least in my district, were little issues such as, I woke up and my youngest child had a fever and I couldn't bundle them up and take them out. Or I got called into an unexpected meeting, which derailed my day. you know, a lot of people are not engaged for very simple reasons like that.
And what about the people with New Haven is if you have two jobs?
Oh, yeah. If you, I mean, there are so many common sense reasons. I like to joke that the same society that will pay more to have their watermelon pre-cubed definitely does not want their voting restricted to one day from 6 a.m. To 8 p.m. And what I tell people, the beauty of this ballot referendum is it will allow for any type of early voting. If the legislature then wants to set it up so we open the polls at 5:30 a.m. instead of 6 a.m., we can do it.
But isn't the idea more you can vote over a period of weeks?
There is no idea, and that's what I like to impress upon people.
But I mean, in terms of the person with the sick kid or the meetings or the two jobs, the 5:30 is not going to help as much as the 5 days.
But it's going to be up to the legislature. So what is on the ballot now is that the legislature can have these conversations. I thought a couple of years back, Denise Merrill recommended opening the weekend prior. A lot of groups that testified in front of the GAE committee last year, I feel like it averaged out at 2 weeks, which would actually match the federal legislation that's in D.C. right now.
So would you support 2 weeks?
I think I would. I would want to hear what anyone is saying who is against 2 weeks, but it seems like not much will change in a two-week period.
I think society's moving that way. I think I'm trying to think what the objections would be. One objection might be things change. So people voting 2 weeks earlier, a week later, it gets revealed that one of the candidates has a private stock interest in a company that has a bad contract with the state, or, you know, had gone to jail. We didn't know that before. Do we need to know everything on the same day, or we always had absentee ballot anyway? Is that okay? Or
I think, first of all, I think people should realize that how information is doled out to them by candidates in their opposition will change based on the calendar. So usually,
like, for instance, Donald Trump was upset the debate took place after early voting started because he wanted a chance to influence every voter.
Yeah. And some states have 45 days, which I think personally is too long, and a lot of people. Because I do think a lot can change. It just feels to me personally, and again, I would listen to what people say, but based on what I've heard, that gives me a lot more trepidation than 2 weeks.
And so tell me, am I wrong? Is that not what the main objection is? Like, what is the main objection?
In terms of early voting? I would ask, I think everyone would have a different answer, right?
But what did you hear on GAE?
GAE, the main objection is to increase accessibility, whether it's caregivers, people with disabilities.
No, that's the support. That's the reason people are for it, right? No, why would they be against early voting?
Usually they talk about time frame, too long, and things might happen.
So it is that issue. They're worried that people vote about it.
That's what I hear the most.
And I guess the other issue, and this gets tied in with the second issue, so then there's no excuses absentee ballot, but anyone mail in. I think Arizona does that. Florida?
Almost many states have no excuse absentee
ballot.
And
that's another measure, right, that we're trying to get up to a referendum. Where do we stand on that?
That was passed with a simple majority. So next session, 2023, it would need to pass again with a simple majority. And then it, too, would be given to the voters to decide.
And do you support that?
I do.
And tell me about why.
I think in general, I hesitate to use the word easier, because that implies less strict, if you would. Most people who vote by absentee ballot, I won't say most, but many people, at least talking to them, are doing so illegally, because our absentee ballot restrictions are quite focused and narrow.
Except during COVID, when you were allowed.
COVID, yeah, exactly. And
so how was it legal? They pretended they had a medical condition they didn't have, or that they'd be
no. you know, there are people who, for example, suspected they might, people like me, commute to the city, they suspected they wouldn't make it back in time to vote, and they voted by absentee, especially in my part of the state. A lot of people do work in Manhattan or New York City. So technically, that is not legal, but a lot of people do it.
So would you say that the reason you're for it is you want it, not that you might get easier, so what's the word you would use? More accessible?
More accessible. More in keeping with modern life, I would say.
Now, I guess I'm trying to think, like, the world changes, so it is easier to do. Because my concern has always been fraud, because as a reporter, I know that people cheat on absentee ballots in cities. And I know that Republicans cheat, too. They had to redo a congressional primary because the guy got elected based on the fake fraudulent vote. But the experience in Oregon, for instance, the Pioneer, they say that there's not fraud when they look at it. I guess fraud would be one of the big concerns about absentee. Like, if you're an elderly person, the elections I've covered, you know, someone comes in, works for the campaign, fills it out for them. They don't know really what they signed, and they put it in the box.
I think that is such a narrow problem that maybe that happens, but I think there's probably other ways to address it rather than...
And I'll acknowledge that all studies done of this have shown that there's not been fraud that would outcome. But what about now? Because now you're running as a Democrat. Why are you a Democrat?
You know, it's funny you ask that. What I used to consider human values growing up, I think have now become democratic values.
Have you always been a Democrat?
I have always been a Democrat, but like many people who were not daily active in politics, I chose my parents' party, you know, in the early part of my life. And as I evolved, I just always... felt more strongly connected to what I now call democratic values. And I also...
What are the examples of those?
Well, and let me just say this. I also negated what, you know, some people say are Republican values that Democrats don't have. I assure you, as a business owner, I believe in fiscal responsibility. But in terms of democratic values, it's hard to divorce my reality as a Black woman, right, with some of the inequities that exist. So I've always believed in access to good education, good health care, and, you know, things like that. I think most people agree with common sense gun laws, regardless of party, but I do consider that a democratic issue right now.
Become that.
It really has.
You know, one issue, one thing you mentioned that really blew me away is the reporting that came out in the last 4 years about inequities in healthcare. That, like, high income, highly educated Black women were not taken seriously by their doctors. And they had worse outcomes. They had more stuff go wrong and more untreated illness and a lot more pain than people who were white, low income, low education. That was deep.
It doesn't shock me at all. It's hard to know what you don't know, right? And I think with the murder of George Floyd,
I was thinking of infant mortality. That's how a lot of that came up.
Well, that too. And a lot of people just didn't understand that some of these things were going on. My niece, whom I'm very proud of, is currently in her residency. And she will tell you firsthand how, you know, because she spent her med school years working in a hospital in a low socioeconomic community. And she was often shocked at how differently people were treated and, you know, it's a real thing. But anyway, yes, there are many inequities, and I think Democrats have done a better job at trying to address those.
And we're talking to Stephanie Thomas, running for Secretary of the State in the race coming up, going for the Democratic nomination. So how's it going on the trail? What are you finding? Have you had events? Harry says 10 days for a November surprise to limit vote harvesting. So he wants you to do 10 days. In any case, if you get to be Secretary of State, you're going to help craft how the stuff gets put into place. Tell me how it's gone on the trail. Tell me about a day on the campaign trail that's been interesting, or has everything been Zoom?
I will, but first I want to say the legislature will be the one who can create the program, but as Secretary of State, I can, of course, give my opinions.
It's not just another opinion.
I know.
I'm asking. I mean, Secretary of State, I think, is looked to as it actually having legislation crafted to introduce.
I think it depends on who's in the legislature, right? I think right now we have a Democratic majority, and when the secretary came to us with some of her ideas, they happened to mesh very well. A good example is automatic voter registration. Denise has been pursuing that. I've been pursuing it, as are many Democrats. So when she came with that proposal, there were friendly ears. I could easily imagine a scenario if the two groups were different parties or had different priorities where those recommendations would not be taken as strongly.
What about ranked choice voting? So Joshua Elliott's a big fan of it. Hilda Santiago skeptical of it. Where do you stand on that?
I think it's a great way for citizens to avoid holding their nose, right? Mm-hmm. How many times have we heard or struggled with, like, my candidate can't possibly win? So I think it solves that hands down. However, when it comes to adopting it right now in Connecticut, it's just not in my top priorities because there are a couple of stumbling blocks. One is cost, of course. You need new machines, new ballots, new training. And with 169 separate towns, you know, that's a lot to orchestrate, fund, etc., and to make sure it's done well. But for right now, what I think is more problematic is the need to transfer ballots from the polling location to another location. There's so much distrust right now. I just don't imagine that people would think that's a good idea. And then the public education side of it. One of the other reasons I'm running for secretary is to really fight for additional funding. I think it is the responsibility of the government to educate its electorate about statewide issues.
So it sounds like a ranked choice voting. You support the concept of theory.
Yeah.
And practice is not top priority because you feel like it cost a lot, it'd be a lot of work, and that you thought it's going to be hard to explain to people?
Yeah. Not so much difficult to explain it, but to get them to understand it. If that makes sense.
It sounds like the same thing to me.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, I would argue to push back because I'm very biased on this.
Okay.
But
okay.
I also believe my bias doesn't matter because every time goo-goo liberals like me think we have some way to fix the system, it ends up creating a new problem and confusing like PACs.
I wasn't going to say that, but
you have to have humility always when you think something's going to fix a problem and not make it worse. I guess when you're talking about civic engagement, if people had more choices and candidates had, the theory is they have to focus more on issues and positive reasons to vote for them rather than destroying one candidate who they might need those voters to vote for them second. Mm-hmm. That ranked choice voting, when you get to keep people in order, in fact, can increase civic engagement and make there be more of a reason to participate positively in politics. But you're saying you don't oppose the theory.
Yeah, what I'll say, Paul, is the key word in that sentence is can, which is different than will.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm not sure that ranked choice voting alone is enough to offset the apathy that we talked about, which is why I think it's just not my top priority at this time. But we sort of meandered, and you asked me a question about how the campaign is going. I've only been in it, I think this is week six, and I think it's going great. Like I said, when I filed December 1st, I was a little hesitant because we had Hanukkah, Christmas, Omicron, New Year's, and I thought, you know, my message will get lost. People are very distracted.
A lot of stuff on their mind.
Yeah, but again, I'll just go back to, I was pleasantly shocked because it just spoke to the level of grassroots support to raise that $31,000 in 31 days, and it's not so much the money, which is important for any campaign, but it's the fact that 300 people took time out of their schedule during this busy month to make it clear to me that they supported my candidacy, what I believe in.
Was this done online, email, where you have in-person events?
No in-person events because of Omicron. And again, the holidays, everyone was away and distracted and busy. I put some things on social media. I did a couple of e-blasts to my existing list. Like I said, no text messages, no phone calls, no buying of lists. I just went to the people who know me best, and I was happy that they apparently think I would do a good job.
So tell me about one day in the first 2 years you've been in the legislature, or something that happened that either made you say, this is why I'm in it, or this is why it's tough.
It's usually the same thing. When it's tough, that's why I'm in it, right? For me, that's a hard question. And again, I'll just go back to GAE. There were a couple of days where we had public hearings, and, you know, this could be 14 hours, 16 hours. And it just became clear to me that a lot of the talking points are taken from the headlines, not based in fact. Maybe based more on emotion. And sometimes I think the legislators just get tired because we try to deal in fact, and it's hard when you're getting a barrage for 14 hours with, you know, saying data that you know might not be true.
Like vaccines.
Yeah. And so it's tough. And my initial thought was, well, let me just let everybody talk, and then I know what the facts are, and in committee we'll have the debate and I'll take it there. But then I chose not to be perhaps what is typically considered appropriate for a freshman, and I decided to just speak up. Because I do like to engage in conversation, and sometimes that 14-hour hearing might have gone to 16 hours because I asked too many questions.
Are you thinking of a hearing in particular when you made that decision, what the issue was?
You know, I can't remember offhand, but definitely, obviously, one of the voting hearings. So either it was automatic voter registration, early voting, or restoring parolee voting rights.
So right now, if you're on parole, you don't have the rights? Just if you're an ex-offender?
Correct. Connecticut had an odd system where people on probation could vote, but not on parole. So we fixed that. Yeah.
And then what about the business side? So everyone runs for Secretary of State always say, and I know about business. Yeah. You say you're right. Now you currently run a consulting business.
I do.
So some people say, I know about business because I run a business. Other people say, I've worked with businesses as a lawyer. What is your pitch? I get your background, what you would do as Secretary of State to make the office better for all the businesses that rely on the Secretary of State for the commercial database, for all the records, incorporation, all that?
I think as a consultant, more than most business people, literally time is money, right? So I think anything that the Secretary's office can do to continue, and I want to say that I think Secretary Merrill and Governor Lamont have done a great job in automating things,
the DMV,
trying to make all these systems talk.
That was great.
It's amazing. It's important, and it takes a lot of work behind the scenes. So I think I would give them big kudos, and I would want to continue in that trend to make sure that all these agencies are able to talk to one another.
Is there something specific that you would change for the businesses dealing with the Secretary of State's office? Or just saying you have a good background, knowing that you'll be able to hear what they need?
I think knowing what they need, it's funny. As a legislator, you know, most of us send e-blasts. And I think, or at least this term, this session, I was the first person. I went to the secretary's office and I said, can I have a list of the businesses in my district? And I created a newsletter just for them that actually, you know, it's different than what I send my constituents because it's business related and it has to do with ways to make their lives easier. And every once in a while, someone will say, are you that Stephanie Thomas who sends me? Like, they don't even know I'm the
state
rep.
Here's an extra pound of cheese. Say, no, I can't take that yet.
But I think it's so important to think about, I mean, I think small businesses are the backbone of this country. I really do. Definitely of the state. And it's really important to listen to what they need. I think as secretary, as a business person, I'm always, as a consultant in particular, you can come in with whatever vision you want, but your client may have a different idea. And you actually have to sit down, collaborate, figure out how to get to where you're going, even if you can't do it the way you want to. And I think part of my style and what I would want to bring to the secretary's role is more of an open door and sitting down community to community, whether it's town clerks or business owners, and finding out what they want and then come up with a product that makes sense.
Stephanie Thomas, where did you grow up?
New Jersey.
Where?
Montclair.
Mm-hmm. They have a good, they had one of the first local news websites there, BaristaNet.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't around when I was growing up, but yeah, I know.
That's kind of gentrifying a little bit in the middle, I saw there, but they have the university there.
Yes.
So when you grew up, did you think you would one day go into politics, or what did you want to do?
Oh my gosh, no. So I grew up in Montclair, which most people know as a wealthy town, but I grew up very poor. You know, my father was illiterate. My mother has a GED. I'm the first of my siblings to graduate from college.
What'd they do for a living?
My father was an auto mechanic, basically, and doing odd jobs like many poor people. And my mother, she worked for a law firm in their copy. I guess back then they called it the reprographic department. And then she also worked part-time at a department store doing security. And then sometimes she worked part-time doing other things.
She liked having to work all around the clock? You didn't get to see her?
No, but you know, that's, well, I mean, yeah, the working poor is a real thing. And I, you know, when I think about my life now, I'll get teary-eyed. When I
That's
was,
allowed, by the way.
You know, when I was sitting at the table doing homework by candlelight because my family couldn't afford to pay the electric bill, to think that I would one day be running for Secretary of the State of Connecticut was not on my radar.
How old were you?
When all of these...
When you were doing homework by candlelight.
I mean, that was probably middle school, high school.
It was more. It sounds like it was more than once.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You'd have your electricity turned off.
Oh, absolutely.
So what did you guys do when that happened?
I used to go to the library after school every day, which plug why I love libraries. They are the greatest institutions in this country. I spent usually there until it closed, and then I would go home.
So you could do your homework?
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a story.
And it took a while before I realized.
Was there heat in the house? Was this in the winter? Or they couldn't turn off in the winter?
Yeah, it would get turned off in the winter. But that was great because then we could keep our food outside and it stayed cold.
So you saw the upside. Tell me more about the library. So this is a softball question.
Yeah.
So you could tee it up. The appreciation for library and civic life when you're a teenager getting your homework done, how does that translate into running for a job known as Secretary of the State?
I just think they're not dissimilar, the Secretary of the State role and the role that libraries play. And I think the capacity, the greatness of both the office and those institutions is to meet people where they are and to really serve the community. And that...
How about making opportunity?
Yeah, that too. You know, the secretary's role, one thing we don't talk about a lot also is the amount of data that they put up on their website, that they store, they track. And that transparency, I think, is really important for building trust also in government. But most people have no idea it's there. And I think libraries are almost like that. They're treasure troves that the more you spend time there, you discover things you didn't know. Wouldn't it be great if people went to the secretary's site and discovered data that they could really use that they didn't know existed?
Were you able to finish the homework by the time this library closed?
Usually.
I think I've been to that library because I was doing research on BaristaNet.
The Montclair Public Library is a great library. I hate to toot my own horn, but, you know, I graduated honor roll.
From the high school?
Yeah, high school, Dean's List, NYU. I hear the playoff music, but...
It's only because we're pissing up our hour. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Anyway, yeah. So I never thought I could run for Secretary of the State, but I'm happy I've made it to this point.
Are your parents still around?
Yeah, my father's deceased. My mother, absolutely, very proud. She will also cry anytime you bring up this topic.
Okay. Well, thanks for being open with us, Stephanie Thomas.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It was really nice to meet you. Really nice to talk to you. People in New Haven don't mostly know you yet, but maybe they'll get to know you because you're in it to win it, right?
I am.
You're an official candidate for Secretary of State. You didn't mess around with exploratory.
Correct.
You're going around the state. You raised $31,000 in 31 days. I noticed you got some kind of marketing chops there when you talk about it that way. It wasn't $30,500 in 31.4 days. And it was really nice to hear what you want to do with the office. And we'd love to stay in touch with you as your campaign goes on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Thanks, Harry Droz, behind the controls, keeping the show going. We're going to take it out, as Stephanie Thomas noted, because you can already hear it, with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. From the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting us to fly with us free all day and all night at WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio.